Hi guys, thanks for tuning in to another episode of Nuggets News, or our monthly housing and economy update with our friend Martin North. How are you, Martin?
I'm extremely well. How are you doing?
Pretty well. There's been a lot happening in the Bitcoin space in our world, which we're going to actually touch on in your slides tonight, which was exciting to see. But what about in the macro world and the housing market, just as an overview for people? What have you been seeing?
Well, I think it's pretty crazy. So, you know, reflect on the global debt clock still rising ever higher. Reflect on the fact that the inflation rates aren't coming down anything like what people were expecting, and that is now putting pressure on whether central banks will or will not be able to cut rates, which of course people were expecting, markets was particularly. We've got stocks, some stocks going through the roof, the magnificent, well, how many is, we'll look at that because, you know, things are going all over the place. Gold's gone up, probably higher than ever before. Crazy. I mean, you know, trying to make sense of this stuff. I tell you, you need a compass and a map and probably keep your eyes shut.
Yeah, in terms of that crazy world, not something that we'll get into tonight, but some of these laws that we're seeing passed in these different countries about if you question the government, or there was a politician that was in a certain social media group that's been arrested. It's just this complete totalitarianism that's happening. I mean, do you have any thoughts on that before we get into the slides?
Yeah, I think it's worth just reflecting on that. We've got the story of central bank digital currencies, which are still being piloted and tested. And of course, one of the things about central bank digital currencies is control. We've got the reining in of free speech through all sorts of channels. And if you are supporting the government, feel free to talk. If you're not supporting the government, then you could get into difficulty. You've also got the question of how much news is actually being shared. You know, Facebook is not paying now for news in Australia. So how do you get the real story out there? How much of it's controlled? How much of it is being filtered? And I guess we have to rely on channels such as our channels to tell the full story, because the mainstream, well, they don't necessarily want to go there.
Yeah, the mainstream, or in America, I think it was, put out a list of 100 or so channels and podcasts that they're targeting. Now, obviously, you and I are a bit too small compared to some of these channels with a million plus subscribers that are trying to put out this word, so we're safe for now. But who knows how long we can keep doing these videos and presenting alternate narratives. So we'll make the most of it while we still can.
Oh, I was going to say, well, we'll do it well for as long as we can do it. But yes, civil liberties and freedoms that have been hard won over many, many decades are being eroded. And, look at the use of cash is another example, right? The problem is that it's a bit of a drip feed, drip feed, drip feed. And you look back and think, gee, how much have changed over the last few years? And trouble is, the speed of change probably is going to continue, not necessarily for the good.
Yeah. Okay, let's dive into these slides of yours. So the Fed want to cut. Some of those estimates have changed, which we might get into, but CPI says not yet.
Yeah, so, you know, Jerome Powell has come out several times and said, we want to cut. But the markets are actually expecting him to cut. But the data is not actually supporting it. So the inflation data that came out yesterday in the US was at 3.2%. 6 months ago, it was 3%. So it's gone the wrong way. And if you look at the core, which is the one that up until quite recently was the one being focused on, didn't go the right way either. But interestingly, the mix of things that have moved, this month it was insurance, this month it was second-hand cars, some of the rental data was a bit weaker, last month rentals was stronger. So the problem is the data is really lumpy and the data is actually very noisy. And so if the Federal Reserve and other central banks are actually really wanting to drive towards rate cuts, they're saying we're not seeing it in the data. And now, are they over data dependent? Probably they are. We've got recessions in Europe. We've got recessions in the UK, Japan. Australia's close to a recession, but the US is still quite strong. But I think markets are still overdoing rate cuts, and I think we're going to see rates higher for a lot longer because the inflation data isn't behaving as expected, unless, of course, they change the target, which they probably won't do, but some are saying they should.
Yeah, the Fed were talking about initially maybe 7 cuts this year, and that's the markets what now pricing in 2.
Yeah, so different people have different views. So there are some people saying we won't get any cuts this year in the US, neither nor Australia. Others are saying, well, there's still room. But then, of course, you've got the election in the US as well later in the year, and that's going to put a gap in when the Fed can work with a cut. So my expectation now is probably no major change to rates until next year, which is going to put a lot of pressure on a lot of people.
Interesting. All right. So next up, you've got some of these large tech stocks that are dominating, and Tesla's pulled back a bit, but the rest of them are still fairly strong.
Well, you know, we had the Magnificent Seven. Now we've got the Magnificent. Well, you know, is Apple still up there? Well, Apple's come back quite a long way. Nvidia ran up, you know, massively high, almost one of the largest stocks in the world in terms of its capitalization, came back a little bit. Tesla, of course, is significantly down. But the point I wanted to make is, if you look at the business of Nvidia versus, let's say, Amazon or Apple, in fact, Amazon and Apple are some of the biggest customers of Nvidia. So what you've actually got is you've got this sort of funny circle of activity between those who are making the chips for AI and those who are seeking to exploit AI. But if you stand back and look beyond that, then the markets are actually behaving quite differently. So the problem I have is this feels a bit like Cisco and Sun Microsystems around the dot-com bubble. You know, Cisco had a PE of 30 at its height. Nvidia is about 30 to 32. Cisco is now significantly smaller in terms of its footprint. So I have a feeling that this is still bubbly territory. And there are some people now saying, well, maybe the Magnificent story is not necessarily so immediate. You know, AI is important. It will come in. It will actually make productivity improvements, but maybe over 20, 30 years. So that would suggest that these stocks are way overrated. And if you go to the next slide, you can see there that the markets are up and away, thanks predominantly to the AI story. If you look at the equal weight, very different story. I mean, it's still going up, but nowhere near as broad. And so the question is it conceivable that the broader market can continue to go higher away from AI? And that's where opinion is highly divided at the moment. So maybe the markets are due for a pullback. And some of the people I've been reading recently are suggesting a 10 to 15, 20% pullback is quite likely in stocks over the next few months as the pressure on the economy continues to rise. The forward expectations of growth are actually quite limited now in many places. So we're in this sort of catch-22 situation where the markets officially look quite good, driven by a small number of stocks. But if you start looking at more broadly, there are other bigger questions.
Interesting point you make there about the input costs. So companies like Apple and others in the AI world that need anything computer or tech related really needs these computer chips. So maybe changing of who holds the power there to some regard. And that's the same for all these companies. If we get this, I guess, rush towards real things, the commodities start undergoing this inflation and whatnot, that they're also large input costs for things like Tesla to make batteries and companies to make things in the real world, build a lot of houses if we have housing shortages. So an important concept for people to have their heads around.
Yes, and it is worth reflecting. Services costs are still rising quite fast, and that's wage related, but the costs of goods are also now starting to reassert themselves. And so there are a number of people suggesting that, in fact, the inflationary impulses are going to be stronger in the next few months ahead rather than weaker. You know, look at the cost of trying to build a house, for example. You know, look at the costs of shipping, which has gone significantly higher because of the Red Sea and those sorts of things. So I think there's a big story here about the fact that maybe inflation is sleeping. It's not dead. And we could see another pulse or two of inflation. If that's the case, then central banks won't have the capacity to cut rates. But I also think that central banks are almost being over data dependent. And I've often used the analogy, they're driving the economy by looking in the rearview mirror and trying to steer appropriately looking backwards. It's not a very effective mechanism, perhaps.
All right, moving on. So as you mentioned, gold's broken out to new all-time highs. Bitcoin's broken out to new all-time highs. These prices that we're looking at on screen are the US dollar prices. So something we've been talking about a lot is how other global currencies are actually relatively weaker to the US dollar. So Bitcoin made new all-time highs in a number of global currencies in the previous weeks and months, and the same for gold. But a pretty interesting situation where there's a heap of US dollars, but all these other currencies are even weaker. So if you went out and bought gold or Bitcoin, or you can even argue, you know, the stock market, if it's priced in Aussie dollars, it just makes these things in the charts look like the performance has been great, but if you're thinking about the denominator, then maybe that's another way for people to think about it.
Yeah, and you know, there's this thing called the milkshake theory, which basically says the US dollar is still the strongest of all the currencies, even if it's not in a great shape. So there's been a very significant sort of gravitational pull to the US dollar, and of course the US economy likes that. But it is interesting. Gold is higher, not predominantly because of retail investors, but a lot of central banks are buying gold. And in fact, if you look at gold ETFs, the volume there is down quite a lot. Whereas in Bitcoin land, of course, the ETFs, the cash ETFs in the US are now still sucking a lot of money. And of course, you've got the halving as well. But it is a very interesting question when you've got markets, you know, the stock markets are high, gold, Bitcoin, you know, all-time highs. It's crazy times, really. And, you know, trying to find true sources of value is an interesting question. And as you say, if you actually are seeing your own currency devaluing and the US dollar still being pretty strong, it's going to play out quite interestingly. I think probably Bitcoin's still got more height to reach yet. The question is, what happens after the halving, and will it settle down, or will it continue to, you know, rocket away? And as for gold, well, we are in new territory, but if you adjust it for inflation over the last 20 years, gold is still significantly down from where it was. And of course, you don't get any returns if you invest in gold. So you know, unlike some other assets where you get you know, real returns, gold is not one of those. And Bitcoin, I still think it's a trading opportunity or a holding opportunity, but I still don't think you should put all your savings in Bitcoin, because I'm not sure where any of this is going yet.
Yeah, and some of those big funds are only suggesting 1-3% for their clients and in their own funds and whatnot. But I'll just quickly bring up that chart, as you mentioned, US debt and global debt in every country is really increasing exponentially. So a lot of people might have seen this stat being thrown around. The US is now going into debt $1 trillion more around every 100 days. And if it continues to grow at this exponential rate, you know, fairly soon it might be $1 trillion every month. And so that's why I think it's a lot easier for someone to understand if you're in Argentina and seeing it hyperinflate away, that I might go into gold or Bitcoin or something to protect myself from what the government and the local central bank's doing. But now that people are starting to hear these figures, $1 trillion every few months or $1 trillion every month, maybe that's why they're deciding that, hey, these other currencies, gold, Bitcoin, whatever else it is, anything that's finite in a world where fiat currency is going parabolic in its devaluation and whatnot, that it kind of makes sense.
Well, it goes back to the question of the value anchor. You know, what is the thing that you basically think reflects the true value of things? And the difference about Bitcoin, it's a finite supply of Bitcoin. Pretty much everything else, you know, all the currencies, you can print as much as you like. Gold, in theory, is finite, although, you know, you can still find it a little bit more around the place. So it does beg the question about, well, what is the value of anything and how do you value that? And I always remind people that, in fact, of course, what's really happening is the value of your dollar is being reduced and reduced and reduced and reduced and reduced. So it's not that the value of things are going up, it's just that your purchasing power is being reduced. And that's the way to think about it in my mind.
Yeah. All right. So what's the neutral rate of interest with the US 2-year and 10-year still hovering between 4-4.5%?
Well, yeah, the real interesting calculation is if you take the inflation around 3 and a bit, and add a little bit for cost of carry, you start to get a neutral interest rate, which is a lot higher than where people were thinking it was going to be. So the original expectation was going to be that we would see interest rates cut quite considerably, and we'd have a neutral interest rate of maybe 2-2.5%. Now, it looks to me as though the neutral rate in the US is probably quite a lot higher than that. And what that means is it's unlikely, even if the Reserve Bank in the even if the central banks in the US or the Reserve Bank in Australia or the, you know, Bank of England in the UK start to cut, they probably don't have much downside capacity to cut because the neutral interest rate's now higher than it was. So we're not going to go back to 0.1%, which was an emergency rate level through a COVID. We're going to see interest rates a lot higher. And so the neutral interest rate, which is, you know, where you get no growth and no compression in the economy, is probably at least 1-2% higher than where people thought it was. So that's another, if you like, floor to how far rates can go.
Yeah, good explanation. China and Japan, worlds apart. We mentioned gold buying before, but we've seen a lot of just Chinese citizens maybe rushing out to buy more gold than normal because of the real estate market and cracks in their financial system as well. So more demand coming from there as well as the central banks you mentioned.
Yeah, it's a really interesting story. So China, of course, if you look at the Chinese market, is significantly down. If you look at Japan, it's the market's considerably up. China is putting a 5% growth target into the economy. They've done some limited stimulus. The property sector is still struggling, and they're stockpiling resources, but it looks to me as though their demand for things like iron ore is down a little bit. China is in a deflationary spin at the minute, and it will continue. Whereas Japan had, of course, much lower rates. They've been in negative rate territory for quite a long time. And now, finally, the Japan story could be changing. We could be seeing the central bank moving into very slightly positive interest rates. And that's going to be a significant shift. But it is worth remembering that Japan is in recession at the moment and inflation is still pretty strong. Inflation is not a problem in China at the moment. It's going the other way.
All right. So next up, we've got a couple of resources. The price of iron ore down quite a bit, and lithium had that monster rally. There's a lot of excitement about electric cars and so on. Now that's pulled back a lot too.
Yeah, and this is very relevant for Australia, of course, because we do export a lot of stuff around the world, and iron and some of the like the lithiums of this world. Yeah, iron ore is down quite a lot. That's what I said earlier on about China's demand tailing away. Lithium shot up. It's now coming right the way back. So there's a really interesting question about the way that commodities and resources are going to play out ahead. Australia is very exposed to that. Of course, we rely on those exports to drive the economy. If, in fact, they continue to go the other way, that's going to put downward pressure on the Australian economy. And there's also a big question now about electric cars, how quickly they're going to actually take up. In fact, some of the producers are producing less cars, and they're talking about a longer adaption period. So a lot to play for, but my point there is, as I look around the various asset classes, even commodities are all over the place too.
Yes. All right. So house prices actually gathering steam in some regard.
So this is now talking about Australia. So yes, the latest data from CoreLogic showed that in some areas, house prices are still rising. Not so much in Melbourne, pretty much flat. Tasmania is going backwards. But everyone's now talking about how much more this can go on. Of course, the debt burden is still quite high for people in Australia. The interest rate pressures are still there. And a lot of people are now saying that maybe we're getting to the point where things will turn around. But at the moment, it's still there. And that's despite, if you go to the next slide, despite higher inflation. So inflation is still high in Australia. But the real question now is the debt to income ratio that households have. And, they're arguing that until such time as interest rates get cut, it's hard to see home prices continuing to rise significantly. And as I said before, the chances of rate cuts probably are, ebbing away. So that perhaps could have a real significant knock-on effect in terms of where home prices go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably still that immigration story, isn't it, that's been the largest factor into an otherwise rising interest rate environment where you expect a pullback in house prices. But so if we continue to see record immigration and not enough houses being built, maybe they can continue to trickle higher with interest rates staying around where they are, or maybe one or two cuts.
Yeah, so it's all about demand, and obviously high migration, and there was a report the other day that said we have 1 million people coming into the country in the last 12 months, which is, if it's true, it's a really high number. Never had that before. And so demand is strong. And talking about demand, if you go to the next slide, you can see there that there's a big discussion about should superannuation be harnessed for the purchase price of properties. And there's a report that came out from Super Members Council that said, well, hang on a moment, if you do that, not only do you lose your benefit of superannuation when you retire, but potentially you can put further upward pressure on home prices. Now, of course, they're involved in the superannuation sector, so you'd sort of expect that, wouldn't you? But my point is that all of these demand strategies, whether it's first owner grants, whether it's pulling out of superannuation, whether it's shared equity schemes, they all are demand strategies. Well, they're not really strategies. They're fixing short term by trying to actually help people buy. But what they're doing is putting more upward pressure on prices. And the modelling that these people did suggested that you would see median price in Sydney rise by 80,000 and maybe Melbourne, 70,000 if this was actually allowed to happen. So I'm afraid that demand type strategies, which is the political short-term fix, is not solving anything. It's just creating the problem and making the problem even worse.
Yeah, as you say, if the house people can take out that larger chunk of money, they've still got to buy it off someone that probably already has that asset and multiple assets. So it still just makes the wealthy wealthier. It doesn't really change that supply problem of building an affordable housing for everyone as like a basic human right, I guess.
Well, I've always believed that finding somewhere to live is a human right. It shouldn't be just purely market conditions. Unfortunately, a lot of politicians are looking at the demand side because it's short-term political fixes, and you'll see another one shortly. But it's also worth highlighting, because you mentioned building, that the HIA has come out and said we don't have enough people to actually work in the construction sector to build the 1.2 million homes that the government's committed to. Therefore, they welcomed Labour saying, well, we'll try and bring more people in and incentivize apprenticeships and incentivize those who actually are training those in the construction sector. We don't have the capacity to build anything like the number of houses. So it's the supply side story. And whilst you can hold up the 1.2 million and say, see, we're trying to do it, you know, New South Wales said, well, no way we can build the number that we need to build. So we've got this big, big problem where the supply side story is just all over the place. And like I mentioned, migration's very high, significant demand incentives, putting more pressure on house prices, but the ability to build going through the floor.
Yeah. New home loans actually falling slightly.
Yeah, this was a bit of a surprise. So people were expecting the home loan market to continue quite buoyant, but of course rates are high. The ability to borrow is tighter now. The borrowing power, in other words, income to capacity to borrow is tight. So not surprisingly, across the board, investors, owner-occupiers and first-time buyers all saw their lending easing back. And that's going to continue. I think we're going to see it more and more difficult because the truth of the matter is that it's harder now than ever before for many people to get a loan. Those who actually are borrowing at higher income multiples, 5, 6, 7, 8, in some cases 9. And that's just meaning they're putting more and more of their incomes to try and buy property. So we would expect that to be another dampening factor on the growth. Of course, I've made the point before, Alex, that the link between credit availability and home prices is very, very strong. If you can get access to more credit, it's the same story, you know, assets prices rise. If you tighten credit, then asset prices don't rise as much. So another dampening factor here.
Yeah, the old saying, a house is only worth how much you can borrow.
Or what somebody else is prepared to pay for it.
Yes. All right. So this is probably a phenomenon we've seen more in other countries with the gig economy taking off sooner, but multiple jobs hit a record high in Australia.
Yeah, I think we're seeing this trend, unfortunately, you know, and it's still only a relatively small percentage, but what we are seeing is more households working multiple jobs to be able to get by. And I see that in my data all the time, part-time jobs, adding two or three jobs onto the full-time job just to try and get by. It's not good, of course, for society necessarily, and it's certainly not good for the individuals because they just basically run out of time to do anything else. But even if you look at the data, those who actually are working multiple jobs, they're still getting under financial pressure, and they're relieving that pressure by borrowing more on credit cards, using buy now, pay later, or cutting back on spending. And, you know, the truth of the matter is that people are running ever harder to try and stand still. And that's no surprise then that retail is somewhat weaker than people expected. The momentum in the economy is quite a lot weaker. And the GDP in Australia was slightly positive, but only just. And that was really only because of big government spending and a couple of specific initiatives, including, by the way, the Voice initiative helped to lift the GDP number, which I thought was quite amusing.
Okay, I didn't know that, mate. That is interesting. Yep. Rental crisis worse than the 90s recession. So as you said, Australia's actually tiptoeing close to a recession, but it's certainly, you know, you wouldn't think that with what we're reading and seeing in the media and inflation and that type of thing. It doesn't really feel like a recession. It's almost like the media and that are trying to keep people positive and not realise. Because of, I guess, unemployment's still low. And there's very different to previous recessions or recession-like conditions, I should say.
Well, we have a GDP per capita recession. We've had that for a couple of years now. In other words, if you look at the size of the cake and divide it by the number of people, you get a small amount of the cake. But the top line GDP number was just slightly positive. And if you look at the data carefully, you can see that a lot of people are still doing quite well. So if you don't have a huge mortgage and you're in a well-paid job and you've got some savings, you're still spending very freely. And we've also got quite a few older cohorts who don't have a mortgage and have got quite good returns now on their superannuation and on their stock market holdings and those things. So we've got a really split economy. We've got some people really struggling, particularly with big mortgages, younger people who are in the rental sector, as you'll see in a second, 70%+ of those in the rental sector are struggling with just paying the rent. But you've got other people doing quite well. And that's part of the issue. We've got a really split economy between those who are doing very well and those not. And as you say, the mainstream like to focus predominantly on those on the on the positive side of the ledger and saying, things aren't too bad and everyone's still at the shops, et cetera, et cetera. But if you look carefully, not everybody is participating.
All right. So next up, we've got one of the Tassie Labor MPs talking about this basically zero down. If you've watched the any of the housing bubble and financial crisis movies, that that term zero down loans, where you don't have to put any money down, and as long as you can afford the repayments, you can have a house. So what are your thoughts on this, Martin?
Well, it goes back to what I said about just, you can do political stunts to get demand up and try and win votes. But if you look at it economically speaking, it's nuts. And Saul Leslake, who's an economist who lives in Tasmania, said it'll just push prices up again. Absolutely. All of those initiatives do that. This is more about trying to win votes than anything else. It's not really a good strategy. And the problem, of course, is that if prices go down, and remember in Tasmania, property prices are falling quite fast at the moment. They're actually falling faster than anywhere else. And what that means is you could actually get into the situation where you get your shared equity property, you don't get any, you don't have any capacity there because you've got no savings, and prices fall. Then what happens? So this is nuts, and I'm afraid that it's a classic end game problem on the demand side of property. They're going to throw more of these. We're going to get more government support. We're going to find more first owner grants, et cetera, et cetera, all on the demand side. But this is all about political stunts. This is not about solving the fundamental underlying property problem we've got.
Okay. So next up, we've got consumer confidence up a little bit.
Yeah, but it's still, up, very slightly. But look where it is. If you look at it compared where it was from 2014 to 2019, it's, much, much lower. Again, remember that this is an aggregate measure. If you look at it by different types of households, those with mortgages, those in the rental sector, they tend to have less confidence. Those without mortgages tend to be slightly more confident. So the story here is that consumers are feeling the pressure. And whatever anybody says about the economy, whatever Chalmers says about everything's turning the corner, the lived experience of many Australians is that this is really, really a very painful time. And I don't see anything changing very quickly. Like I said, I don't see interest rate cuts quickly. And so this is going to put more downward pressure on the retail sector and more broadly on the economic activity. And as I mentioned before, the China story is also turning even more negative, and the resource question is now really coming quite big. And if we do get that downturn there as well, that's another downward leg in terms of the Australian economy. So consumer confidence is unlikely, in my view, to come up to a long-term average anytime soon.
Okay. So next up, mortgage stress, fastest pace in the last 2 years.
Yeah, so this is now starting to get headlines. For a long time, people weren't talking about this other than those who actually followed what I was doing. But now, the AFR is reporting mortgage arrears are higher. Interestingly, they said the delinquencies are highest in Western Australia, and that is mirroring data from S&P as well as from other sources as well. And what I find interesting is that a lot of the issues in Western Australia were created when prices went really high a decade plus ago, came down, went sideways. The point I want to make is that the arrears story takes years and years and years to play out. So, you're not going to see a lot of pressure in the short term necessarily, but it's building. And so, depending on how you define stress, this is a bit of a headline, which I think is really important to watch. And in my data, I'm seeing Western Australia and definitely the most significant pressure point at the moment on stress. But it's broadening, and more people, as you'll see shortly, are in difficulty.
Yeah, so Australians spending half of their income on mortgage repayments.
Yeah, this was another separate report that came out. And again, I see it in my data too. More people are spending more of their income on just paying the mortgage or the rent. And so the cost of housing relative to everything else is just going higher and higher and higher. And, you know, look at the rents as well. This is from Philip Suz, who basically highlighted the fact that the rents have doubled compared to household income while the vacancy rates declined. You know, the housing sector is broken, significantly broken. We have massive issues. The politicians are looking for short-term fixes and political fixes, but not actually wanting to tackle the fundamental underlying, which of course is to do with migration, and also to consider much more carefully strategies that could really turn the corner. Obviously, supply side is part of it, but unfortunately, we're seeing a short-term knee-jerk, and a lot of this is being done not necessarily to provide long-term solutions, but to try and win the next election, which is a real problem.
Yeah, the short-term votes thing is probably even a bigger issue in the US with migration and that. We haven't really seen that in the news in Australia or people talking about that, but maybe that becomes more relevant in the future if we continue at the current pace as well.
Well, certainly in the US, the migration question is one of those issues being debated. And of course, later in the year, there's going to be another presidential election. I expect migration to be one of the big stories. I'm not going to comment further on the craziness over there. I'll just say that in Australia, it's pretty crazy here too.
Fair enough. Let's go to your data, Martin, on mortgage stress and particularly rental stress.
Yeah, just briefly, I wanted to highlight this. So I measure stress very early. I measure it in cash flow terms right at the start when people start having difficulty. And unfortunately, more than 73% of those in the rental sector are now struggling with cash flow. Doesn't mean they don't pay their rent, but it means they're having difficulty paying other things and cutting back where they can. Health expenditures down, in some cases, taking kids out of private school if they had that option. In some cases, not eating and not getting health insurance, not getting insurance for the place where they live sometimes as well. So there's a lot of people cutting a lot of corners, and mortgage stress is also up as well. Half of households now are in mortgage stress. Again, on a cash flow basis, it doesn't mean they're all going to default tomorrow. But like I said earlier on, this is a long-term problem because ultimately, if you're in a mortgage situation and you're not able to keep those payments going, the bank will try and help for a period of time. But at some point, the bank might come round and say, right, well, maybe you should sell the property. And we're seeing a bit of a rise now at the moment, not in bank-driven sales, so not foreclosures, but people are being encouraged to flex their loan, extend the term, go interest only, in some cases, but they're also being now encouraged to sell, get out, release the equity, and to pay the bank off. So that's another factor that's not necessarily being understood in the mainstream media, that actually the banks are putting some pressure on people to sell. And that, I think, is something we're going to see more of. And by the way, the debt-to-income ratio, according to the RBA, is still very, very high. And, of course, that's not the full story because that's all households, not just the borrowing households. The truth is that a lot of new borrowers are 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 times income at the moment, which is crazy, crazy.
Yeah, if you have been contacted by your bank or a broker with a conversation like that, let us know in the comments down below. Martin and I read them, and a lot of other people enjoy hearing what's happening around Australia behind closed doors, I guess.
Well, I think it's important to understand that there are people who are having very difficult conversations at the moment, and quite often the mainstream don't want to hear about them. And I find quite often in the chat on my channel, there are people saying, oh, you're making it up, it's not really as bad. Well, I'm sorry, the surveys have been running for a long, long time. And I made a show the other day called Pop Goes My Budget, which was about just this point, that actually a lot of households are struggling with their budgeting, finding it really difficult to make ends meet, are cutting significant corners. And of course, everyone's holding out for this idea that, well, interest rates are going to come down. But what if they don't come down? What if in a year's time, inflation is still above target and interest rates are still higher than where they perhaps were when people took out those loans originally? And by the way, there's still some people moving from fixed rates to variable rates and still being hit by higher rates. So all of those things are playing out. I guess the bottom line is, if you've got a a financial pressure, get a budget, make sure you understand what the money is looking like coming in and going out. If you've got a loan, talk to your bank, but also bear in mind the bank's going to look after their interests, not just yours.
Yeah. All right. So we've had a few different meetings about possible solutions and different ways and studying the financial system. This is stuff we've spoken about at length, particularly about how raising interest rates tends to hurt the lower middle class more than the wealthy. But what are your thoughts on some of these things that have been happening, Martin?
Yeah, so the Council of Financial Regulators made their report, and this is, of course, the Reserve Bank, it's ASIC, it's APRA, it's the Treasury. So this is, if you like, the think tank that's really controlling the economy. And they came out and said, well, the financial system is a little bit under pressure at the moment. It warrants close attention. Hardship applications have risen materially over the past year. There's an increase in the share of households that have fallen behind on loan payments, even from historically low levels. And they are expecting further increases ahead. The risk to household balance sheets and financial stability would increase if the inflation were to remain high for longer than anticipated, or if the labour market conditions deteriorate more than expected. So the point there is, once you start seeing unemployment rise, that's a leading indicator of pressure ahead. Unemployment's still quite low at the moment, but it could well rise, or indeed if rates stay high. So it's interesting now that the official story from the Council of Financial Regulators is one of a financial pressure building and rising. That was a relatively new point for them to make, and I think it's certainly reflecting what I'm seeing in my data. The other point they made was about the commercial real estate sector. I've been watching this quite closely, and I've been saying that I'm really concerned about what I'm seeing with commercial real estate in Australia and internationally. And in fact, the Council of Financial Regulators called both out. So they're saying the risks in Australia are rising, but the risks overseas from the commercial real estate could be transmitted to domestic markets. And so they're looking at that very closely. And on the next slide, just to sort of round that out, it's now getting reported in the mainstream media as well. So investors in listed properties are in for a bumpy ride over the next 18 months. And the reason for that is simply this. A lot of these investment property trusts hold commercial real estate that doesn't get marked to market that often. Now, the value of real estate's dropped significantly, 20, 30% in some areas, even more elsewhere. So the question is, what happens when they have to reflect those written down valuations in their balance sheets? We're seeing some of that in the US at the moment, and we're going to see more of it. We've got issues in Australia, but it's interesting that a lot of the stuff in Australia is not held among the major banks, but some of the other smaller banks. And so the spread of the risk of the commercial real estate story is not equally spread across the financial system. We're going to see a lot more of this ahead, I think.
Yeah, and I've just got that quick slide there that people can see that the foreign banks have got twice as much exposure to Australian commercial real estate than the local banks. But yeah, interesting point. We have spoken about this a little bit in previous shows. If that mark to market is now 20% lower, and we've seen a lot of these funds say, oh, you can't sell, or we've halted, or you can only sell 10% a month or whatever it is. So if you've got your super and you want to go to all cash, or you want to put some into gold or crypto or whatever, for example, you might not be able to sell that wealth of yours that you think's there, because your Aussie super fund or whatever has got such a big chunk in that commercial real estate in their portfolio. So it is an important concept to understand.
Yeah, and just to say again, it's not marked to market very regularly. So you can sit on these losses for quite a long period of time, hoping that things turn around. But at some point, you've got to crystallize those losses. And when you crystallize those losses, that's a big issue. So we're going to see a lot more about crystallizing losses, I think. And, I could go into other asset classes and we could see quite similar things too. So I don't think the financial system is anything like as strong as other people are claiming at the moment. And we already saw last year a couple of wobbles in the US in the banking system. The Fed, bailed them out pretty much immediately. Watch the financial system closely. I don't think it is as secure and safe as perhaps some people would suggest that it is. So it's just watching and being alert.
All right. Thanks as always, Martin. Hope you guys have enjoyed that one at home. Links to follow all Martin's work down below, and links to follow all our crypto research and update down below as well. And we'll see you next month. Cheers, Martin.
Cheers. Take care.